All right, well, we've caught up with the tech world. Let's turn now to the legal world. Nancy Gertner, former Massachusetts federal judge, she's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst, regularly joins us, and she's in the studio now. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Nice to be here again.
Okay, so as usual, lots of interesting cases, but there's two in particular, one in Massachusetts and one federal one, that I'd love to talk with you about. This first one was just decided by the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, and let me just give folks some background who may not have been following the SJC this week. It's the case of Partnin versus Gallagher, and they are two women who were in a same-sex relationship, weren't married. One of them is the biological mother of their two children, and for roughly 12 years, they shared parental responsibility until they separated. But after that, Julie Gallagher, who's the biological mother, said that her former partner has no parental rights. And Karen Partnin, the former partner, has asked the SJC to rule that she is the children's legal parent or has parenting rights. I know my answer to this, but why do you find this case so fascinating?
Well, it's part of the implications, following along the legal implications of the SJC and now the Supreme Court's decision to allow the same-sex marriages to be recognized. Because the question is, the statute that talked about how to, you know, who's a parent is, first of all, in gendered terms, talked about the man is presumed to be the father of the child. And so the first thing was to sort of deal with same-sex marriages where, you have two people of the same sex and there's nobody presumed to be the father of the child. And then in addition, this was a situation. What's interesting about the case, which you don't initially get when you read it, is that the non-biological parent was not in a position to adopt because at the time, adoptions were not available to same-sex couples in Florida, which is where they were
at the time.
So this case is all about how do we begin to apply provisions of the law that were clearly intended for heterosexual couples, married couples, to this new world of same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages?
Okay, so the SJC ended up deciding in favor, right, of Karen Partnin, the woman who was seeking parental rights here.
Right.
And those parental rights would include making decisions about the children's education, medical care, and religious upbringing.
As well as support. The support issue wasn't before the court. It was in a separate proceeding. But one can only assume that she's going to be obliged to support the children. So having a relationship as a parent is a corollary of that.
So has the SJC then changed what the legal definition of a parent is in Massachusetts?
They really haven't. They've applied it to a situation of a same-sex couple, non-married, non-adoptive, so that the person who's seeking parental rights has to establish that she meets the criteria for parenting. The criteria that would be whether or not, the child is underage, he jointly with the mother, again, the statute, I'm reading from the statute, which is gendered, received the child into their home and openly held out the child as their child. And that's what we would do if it is a man in a non-married situation. And this is applied now to a woman in a non-married situation.
That is the statute as currently written.
That's right.
Okay, so it is rather vague then.
Yes.
Because this is my big question about this case. I mean, it seems as if by extending parental rights to this couple, I mean, whether it's the same sex or not, they weren't married. I mean,
right.
That's one of the key things here. And there was no formal adoption agreement.
Right.
There wasn't even any kind of signed voluntary legal paperwork of any kind. I mean, is the SJC saying that from this point forward, the state can decide on a case-by-case basis who is a parent or who has parental rights, that it is so vague?
There's no question that that's the case. And part of it is allowing the parties to make a showing about the relationship between the parties. Here, for example, the non-parent, the non-biological parent was originally she tried to get pregnant and she could not, and so her partner did, and so she was participating in the birth, participating in the parenting, and the court. It doesn't say that any of this is automatic. It says that she has to be given an opportunity to make that showing.
But there's this question of involvement then,
right?
I mean, that's what Justice Barbara Link wrote. She wrote that Partnin was involved in the decision-making for the children.
Openly held out the child as their child. And so you do have to go back and unpack this relationship and unpack the relationship to the children.
But are you comfortable with, it seems as if the SJC has opened the door to saying, well, the state can be the ultimate arbiter in deciding what involvement is.
But, you know, that's very interesting. Whenever a marriage or a relationship dissolves and you find yourself in court, the state is the arbiter. At that point, the state is invited in. When children are concerned, the state has to be the ultimate arbiter because the state is essentially protecting the children. So, yes, that's what they didn't need permission to marry. They didn't need permission to have children. But when the relationship dissolves, then someone has to adjudicate. Somebody has to identify what the relationships are.
I want to play a quick piece of tape here from Jennifer Lamana. She's the lawyer for the children's biological mother, Julie Gallagher, the woman who did not want to extend parental rights to her former partner. This is from oral argument before the SJC in April.
What Partnin seeks in this case is a path to parenthood that doesn't require marriage, doesn't require adoption, doesn't require a signed voluntary acknowledgement of parentage, and in fact can be imposed without the consent of a parent and over the objection of a fit parent.
Judge Gertner, react to that. It seems as if Lamana is saying that there were extant avenues that Partnin could have followed that would have prevented this case from ever even needing to go to court.
Well, the question is how much of the court is going to hinge this on the formal relationship. As I said, adoption wasn't possible, at least during part of this time, because that wasn't available. I suppose they could have made it contingent on marriage, but one of the things that the court says is you don't want to impose that, for example, on unmarried heterosexual couples. With unmarried heterosexual couples, the court has to look at, it's not just a question of paternity, which goes to the issue of support, but in terms of parental rights, you're going to be adjudicating that anyhow in an unmarried male-female relationship. So it's not a leap here to have to litigate that in an unmarried female-female relationship.
Well, before we move on to another big case here, there's one last question I have to ask you, because there are implications, it seems, for this SJC case in other kinds of families, because families are changing so much, right, in this day and age. But there are lots of people who could play a parental role in a child's life, aunts, uncles, grandparents frequently.
Right.
I mean, does this case could have an impact on them? Or even also conversely, could it have an impact in cases where someone returns to a child's life after some time? And there's fraught couples where someone might say, I am now exerting my parental influence. Shouldn't I have those rights?
With respect to the first, which is that somebody, aunts, uncles, et cetera, I mean, the statute clearly has in mind a dyad, a female, male, female, female, female couple. It talks about who he jointly with the mother receives the child and openly holds out the child as their child. So I don't think aunts and uncles quite fit into that category, the holding out provision. As far as somebody who is out of the child's life and returns, it would be hard to establish a consistent relationship. While no one has talked about it in this case, I've always wondered whether part of this is a version of the law that looked to the best interests of the child. In other words, it's a relationship inquiry. It's a what makes sense for the child inquiry. And this follows along those lines.
All right. Well, that's a look at the SJC case of Partnin versus Gallagher. Let's move up to the federal level, because there is a huge case before the Supreme Court of the United States. It's been getting a lot of attention. It's the case of Dwayne Buck. Now, he is a convicted murderer in the state of Texas. He was found guilty of a murder back in 1997. And during his sentencing hearing, the state of Texas sought the death penalty. And in order to secure it, the state had to prove that Buck was a continuing threat to society. Now, a jury ultimately did hand down the death penalty to Duane Buck, and his penalty rested in part on testimony given during his sentencing hearing that Buck was more likely to commit violent crimes in the future because he is black. Now, his case is currently in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. What is the court being asked to decide here?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated. The court is asked to decide whether he should have a right to be heard. In other words, all of the lower courts threw the case out of court because of a procedural error. It's a troubling situation. The trial lawyer, the underlying allegation here is that the trial lawyer was ineffective because quite clearly he put on the testimony of someone who was going to sink his client. But in addition, the lawyer...
Well, let me just stop you there because we should spell out in detail this particular testimony.
He says...
It was given by a psychologist named Walter Quijano.
Right. Who says that that Mr. Buck's race was a statistical factor that increased his probability of being a future danger. Now, in Texas, in order to get the death penalty, you have to show future dangerousness. And the argument that the government was making, the government took this factor, apparently this man, by the way, had testified in at least five other cases, mm-hmm. and argued that this proved his future dangerousness. And when you think about it, that is a shocking, horrifying argument.
But let's recall he was put on the stand by Buck's own attorneys,
yes,
though.
Yes, that's right. So the claim here is that this attorney, by the way, who was responsible, as Adam Liptak reported, for almost 20 executions in Texas, was extraordinarily incompetent, and that almost seems to be clear on its face. Worse yet, Mr. Buck had an appeals lawyer who also didn't raise the claim. Not an appeals lawyer, it was a habeas corpus after his conviction, but that lawyer who represented him in that also didn't raise the claim in the appropriate way. So he gets into court with a trial lawyer who didn't raise it, a habeas lawyer who didn't raise it on his second habeas petition, at which point all of the courts say, wringing their hands essentially, I'm sorry, there is a procedural problem in your raising this issue, death.
Okay, so let me just jump in here, because this case gets ever more interesting the more you dig into it, because you had mentioned, this psychologist who was on the stand in Duane Buck's case and who he initially raised a statistical number saying that minorities are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. On cross-examination, the district attorney then basically puts the question to him and says, are you saying that because he's black, he's more likely to be continually dangerous? And essentially the psychologist says yes. Now, this man, the psychologist, had testified in a bunch of other cases.
Right.
The state of Texas then later on recognized that this was wrong. And for six people, for six convicted...
Six
total,
yes.
The state promises to have a new sentencing hearing, which
right.
they do, but they didn't do it for Duane Buck, even though he was one of those six.
Right. And the argument that they make before the Supreme Court is because his claim that the term of art is procedurally defaulted, that his lawyer didn't raise the claim in the appropriate way, as I said, and that was patently true. But when you step back from this, whether or not, it seems to the public and to me actually absurd that a procedural default could keep a court from hearing something this serious.
Well, let me just play a little bit of tape here, Judge Gertner, because this case is really remarkable. This is a tape that we found from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. It's a video, and it features a woman named Linda Geffen. Now, and she is a former assistant district attorney in Harris County, Texas, where Duane Buck was first tried. And she actually was on the prosecutorial team for Duane Buck. And now she is actually in support of his appeal. Here's what Linda Geffen says.
I've never taken a stand in favor of an appeal on any other case. This case stands out because life doesn't give you very many opportunities to stand up and correct a wrong. And when you're given that opportunity, you should seize it, make the most of it, and try to make it right.
So, Judge Gertner, this brings me back to one of my initial questions, and that is, this case got to the Supreme Court on technical issues, as you say. Could the justices make a decision that goes deeper than that, that gets to the underlying principles which so many people find so disturbing here, that anyone would testify that a person is more likely to commit a crime because they're black? Could the Supreme Court come down with a decision that prevents that from ever happening in an American court again?
Not directly, because they will be dealing with two issues. One is, was the lawyer ineffective in presenting this testimony, and did that fundamentally prejudice the proceeding? That's going to be the first issue, and that would be the basis for a narrow decision. The second is this kind of error the kind of error for which they should not consider a procedural default? Is this the kind of error? In the oral argument, they were also talking about really chiding the Fifth Circuit, which is the Court of Appeals here, for basically ignoring, letting many of these cases die on the vine, and whether they should say something about the way the Fifth Circuit is dealing with procedural matters. That's the broader issue, and that's actually, it's not a sexy an issue, but that's actually a very troubling issue, because numbers of death penalty cases don't even get heard because of procedural errors.
In 2011, the Supreme Court stayed Duane Buck's execution. It has not been commuted, though.
That's right. That's right.
And we have a 4-4 court. I mean, but we have an 8-member court right now, I should say, which could come down as a 4-4 decision here. I mean, do we get any sense from oral argument what the justices are thinking?
Well, the oral argument actually is described by Adam Liptak was remarkable, because it was not just the people that one would expect to be sympathetic to these kinds of claims, but apparently Justice Alito, who is not sympathetic to death penalty appeals at all, also suggested that this was a case that really shocked the conscience.
Hmm. Well, Nancy Gertner is a former Massachusetts federal judge. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thank you so much today. A couple of complicated cases, but very important for society here in Massachusetts and across the country. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.